Hello everyone and welcome to the Review of Democracy, the online discussion platform of CU's Democracy Institute. My name is Astar Horvat, I am a research assistant at the DI Inequalities Workgroup, and it is my great pleasure to welcome today's guest, Philip Ayoub, who is a professor at the Department of Political Science and School of Public Policy at the University College London. Hi Philip, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Hi Astar, it's really been very nice to be here the last days.
First, please give our listeners a short background on how you came to research LGBTQ activism and what are some of the recent problems that occupy your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I've been researching this now for about 20 years, and it was came mainly to, through personal interest on the topic. And also in the mid-2000s, there were a lot of surprising changes that were happening around the world, but there was also really persistent backlash to LGBT rights. And so while we saw some cases moving forward and things, honestly, that I didn't expect 20 years ago, that we'd be living in a world where so many countries have marriage equality, really, those were seemed like momentous changes at the time. But there was also, many states that were doubling down and not wanting to move forward. So that created a bunch of puzzles for me that I thought were interesting and led then to my dissertation work, which then led to my my book and other publications.
Right.
And in terms of what keeps, what the ongoing things I'm thinking about, well, unfortunately, a lot of these problems still persist. I mean, there's still good news stories, but there's also a really continued struggle around LGBT rights. So activists, even in countries where they're seen as, rights have been won, we have a lot of serious challenges. In the United States, for example, there are over 400 live bills right now in state parliaments around trying to curtail the rights of trans people there, which in the UK, where I live now, is also a really problem topic where, the political establishment is really using this issue to kind of stoke threat. And so we see a lot of really troubling things. And as we'll talk about later in the podcast, also working in other parts of the world, we see that, LGBT rights at a really even minimal basis haven't been introduced yet. So for political scientists, this is a topic area, I think, that for better or worse, provides a lot of important questions to study. And that's why I've still stuck with it, I guess.
Right, for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you also active in the civil society in activism, or is it an academic interest for you?
Well, it's mainly been academic interest. Before I became academic, I was involved in civil society and I was deeply passionate about it. I had some own issues myself with kind of how visible or out to be, and I was never so much a leader in that work, but a kind of active and eager participant. But then I saw my role shift quite quickly in academia, which I don't think it needs to. There's many fantastic scholar activists, but I feel closely connected to the movement in many countries. I have many friends who are, leaders in civil society and who've offered me a lot of their time. And so I always see my responsibilities also giving back to civil society as much as I can. And what academics can do, I think, is also look at the, bird's eye view and look at comparisons that sometimes civil society really knows about. I mean, often I feel like we say nothing interesting to civil society who's dealing with these problems on the ground all the time, but there are patterns that academics can detect. And also academics can sometimes give legitimacy to things that that civil society activists are developing or working on, and thus we can support the movement in that way. And then finally, I also think just being a teacher as part of academics jobs where you have inspiring young people who would probably, who do have more innovative ideas and have great ways in terms of their pulse on having their pulse on activism. You can kind of inspire, future generations of civil society that way. So I've seen my role change a little bit. I guess I'm more in the academic side of things, but I feel closely connected to civil society nonetheless, just with a bit of a different role that I play.
Great. You've already mentioned this, that in the early 2000s, the LGBTQ movement has gained the momentum, and you also kind of explored this in your earlier book, When the States Come Out. Could you elaborate on this question, on why you think that it has gained the momentum, and how did this wave change, how a backlash is now being made in the States against these rights?
Yeah, well, the book When States Come Out was really trying to highlight, alongside domestic explanations, also international ones. So there had been a lot of thinking, I think, in the early literature that, you know, certain countries that would be ripe for LGBT rights would have to be very secular or would have to be very rich. And so we had countries like, you know, like the Netherlands or Sweden come up as kind of ideal type studies. But in the mid-2000s, we did see a lot of kind of interesting countries that we didn't expect starting to move, including in Central Eastern Europe. There was a lot of variation. Some states really doubled down and did not move, and others did. And that, you know, posed a lot of puzzles. And also for me in the book, shined a light on the transnational and international factors that supplement the domestic explanations. Mm-hmm. And so taken together, you know, the reason I argue why we can see these LGBT rights norms diffuse to so many different countries is that some countries are actually deeply connected in their international societies. There are certain channels, you know, social channels, political channels, and also a long history of transnational movements that connect states across borders. And countries that are really connected with those movements do find themselves, their governments find themselves having a lot more pressure to adopt these rights. And so these three international channels, I argued, supplement the domestic ones. The domestic ones are still really important. I mean, there are domestic conditions that make it much harder for LGBT rights in some cases than others, but the transnational and international channels are part of the story. That's why you see in a very short amount of time many different countries moving forward on a particular LGBT rights issue like anti-discrimination or marriage equality. You know, without those factors, it would be much harder to explain why, you know, multiple dozens of states have a certain rights policy in a very short amount of time. So it's not just the domestic. Mm-hmm. And that was the book deals a lot with resistance as well to get to the second part of your question. And there are certain domestic conditions, which I think we'll talk about later in the podcast too, that do lead to more intense opposition to these international pressures. So when they start coming in, there can be different degrees. You know, some countries move more steadily without much pushback. Others move, double down in their resistance. And so the second half of the book dealt a bit with the question of predicting when it will be tougher.
Yeah, I imagine that also in Central Europe, this would be also connected to states entering the EU around the early 2000s and kind of implementing more liberal thinking or like getting more funding for civil society that deals with these kind of human rights. So I was also researching some of the earlier prides in Budapest, mm-hmm. which were in their language, they were quite different than what now we use in the human rights scene. But I think that fundamentally they had the same, I mean, I feel like they have kind of the same struggles that we have with the prides and with the LGBTQ mm-hmm. rights now as well, mm-hmm. because even though the society's tolerance is increasing and they are getting used to having neighbors that are LGBTQ or queer or having acquaintances and getting used to using kind of the language that they're used to describe themselves, but still because of, you know, politicians who go against it and that are using language or kind of viewing it as a foreign imposed thing, which is a common thing, as you mentioned yesterday in your talk, in Africa, in Zimbabwe, but it's a common thing as well here in Central Europe.
Yes.
So I think that politicians are using this basically everywhere as a tool, as a political tool. So, yes. One of my questions would be when you talk about in several articles, but the most recent one is when do opponents of LGBT rights mobilize? Is this political homophobia? Like, when do you think this can be a political tool? Do you think it is more connected to the populist's language? And how do you think that it can be fought against in different contexts?
Yeah, that's great. And I fully agree. And that paper that you mentioned with, which I co-authored with Douglas Page, does look, so indeed, yes, I mean, LGBT rights are presented as kind of foreign imposition in many different countries that and many different world regions. That's unfortunately because gender and sexuality are often presented as kind of fluid issues. A lot of times, populists or nationalists, political elites in general might use use these issues to kind of present LGBT people as a threat to the fixity of nation or the fixity of tradition or religion, and kind of galvanize their own political opposition by targeting LGBT people. Sometimes even before a movement is asking for anything in a country, political leaders will do that, which deals with the political homophobia concept as well, that scholars like Meredith Weiss and Mike Bozia have been developing for some time. But that piece with Douglas showed, you know, that when political elites use this threat construction and this language, it also does work. You know, if you have countries that use this language overwhelmingly, it does also galvanize certain people who have conservative views or intolerant views towards LGBT people. It basically makes them feel like more efficacious political actors, because they're priors, which are quite problematic priors, but they might be confirmed by the political elite and the establishment, and thus might influence them to be more politically active. So that paper unfortunately argues that, you know, in some countries, when tolerant people have their priors affirmed by the government, that also mobilizes more tolerant people. But if you have governments that really present LGBT people as a threat and target them, that also will mobilize certain people to be politically active that might not otherwise be as politically active, right? Because it makes them feel like they know something about politics, and makes them feel like efficacious political actors, that they have something to contribute. That's an unfortunate finding, but it's one that might explain some of the polarization we see in the world, and might also explain why so many illiberal actors do use this kind of language. And that would be, of course, in authoritarian states where we see it a lot, and states where we see democratic backsliding. It's also language we see amongst certain political parties in states that we would consider gay-friendly. So if you think of, you know, in the United States, if you think of Ron DeSantis's policies, including the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, it's using a lot of the same drumming up threat that all of a sudden, you know, with no evidence at all, drag queen story hour becomes something to worry about for people. This, of course, not a real problem, but it's a way to kind of give something to a part of the political electorate that makes them feel like their thoughts are valid, and then maybe also galvanizes them politically in that process.
You also have this other article with Douglas Page and co-author Sam Witt, where you analyze the LGBTQ movement in Bosnia and Herzegovina and bring the example of the Pride in Sarajevo. Do you think that, because you argue that the local support increased towards the movement after the Pride, and I feel like that, you know, this was kind of, for example, in Hungary, this would be a more better argument in also the early 2000s when there weren't like this kind of anti-LGBTQ propaganda media saying that the Pride is not a positive kind of movement, but a negative one, where, for example, pedophiles are marching on the street and such things. So would you still agree with this finding, or do you think that this has now changed in other like conservative societies?
No, I still think the finding holds, but of course it matters a lot on the context. And so that paper was looking at the first ever Pride in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Right. Yeah. And so what I really like about that that paper with Sam and Douglas was the research design, because we looked at, you know, we tracked attitudes before this event happened and after. I should qualify that activists in Bosnia-Herzegovina have been, working very carefully on planning this for a long, long time, and also decided in many cases not to host it. So the point of the paper is not that everyone should have a first Pride. It's really risky, and it comes with a lot of important threats. But if it is planned carefully in a context that is quite socially conservative, that means attitudes are quite low towards LGBT people, and also maybe the visibility of LGBT people is also still lower than in many other places, what's interesting, a march like this, how its effects are spread. And so what you said about the media is actually really interesting, because one of the reasons we found initially that there was more positive changes proximate to the march was because people actually could interact with the real march and see that it wasn't that threatening at all, that, you know, the people who were part of the march were local people who were, you know, part mm-hmm. of their communities. And it also provoked conversations at the dinner table where, you know, they were, people found out their kids were supportive of their friends who were at this march, etc. But that, of course, the further you got away from it, it opened the door more for problematic media portrayals, like you said, for other kind of more dissipating effects and entering of a debate around the issue that was, you know, that was partly a fictitious debate, but one that in Sarajevo itself, because the march happened there, was harder to have, because people actually saw it and knew that, you know, this threat drummed up of you know, decadent, degenerate people walking around was not what they actually saw with their own eyes. Right. And so when you got further away from it, it did challenge that. Even though we did find another paper, actually, when we tracked attitudes in Bosnia sometime down the road, that actually there were downstream effects later, that actually we see slowly more positive attitudes also elsewhere in the country, which we didn't see initially in the weeks after the march, which could have a lot to do with the fact that, you know, people in other parts of the country start developing this conversation when you see you have a visible movement representing you. There's also the planning of other, more activism in rural areas or areas outside of the capital. There's also maybe more people who felt inspired. And actually, a lot of the activists said that queer people, even though, you know, the pride didn't travel as far for straight people, but queer people were very inspired. They all, the many knew about the pride, they heard about it, they felt moved by it, mm-hmm. and thus that might have also led to more activism or more, you know, right. more conversations in other parts of the country. So, but in terms of how that travels, you know, I think there is something about how the mechanism of how the interaction is important and the contact, that is a finding that I think will travel to most places. But whether prides should happen and how they should happen, or if other tactics should be used that are less visible, is also point of that paper, that there's different kind of conditions under which this kind of visible activism makes sense or not. Yeah,
right. You mentioned, and I was also asking about this kind of traveling notions. You have this earlier article in which you compare Poland and Slovenia. Yes. And I think that the main notions there are the attitude of the church and kind of the nationalistic views. So could you tell our listeners about this comparison that you made in this article?
Yeah, so I actually am happy to talk about the article, because it's, you know, one of the rare things that you write that I actually quite like looking back at. It was a paper that came out of my dissertation work. It led to an article called With Arms Wide Shut, which was published in the Journal of Human Rights. And it has surprisingly had quite an impact, that article, and I was really happy about it, because it was a very kind of, you know, more kind of an in-depth qualitative piece looking at two stories in two different countries that responded very different to the LGBT rights norms that the EU had been developing, with it working out more smoothly in Slovenia than in Poland. And Slovenia has actually, since the paper was written, also moved forward. It's really becoming a leader when it comes to full marriage rights and, you know, for families, etc., has moved forward in a really impressive way, where Poland has moved forward a lot in attitudes as well, but the conservative government keeps doubling down on LGBT people and still stoking a lot of threat, and they do so quite successfully. And so the explanation for that was, you know, why the norm provokes more resistance in Poland had a lot to do with the way religion was embedded in the national identity. And that's an important complication there, because I really wanted to challenge the idea that religion or a certain type of religion was just uniformly bad for LGBT people. Indeed, we do see a lot of variation. So at the time, there was a lot of writing that, you know, Catholic states might be particularly bad for LGBT rights. But that had a harder time explaining, you know, why did Catholic Ireland introduce marriage equality by popular vote, or Spain has become a leader, you know, Malta sits on top of and Portugal. I mean, there's so many examples that challenge that. And Slovenia is also a Catholic country that has moved forward quite quickly. So actually, this was in conversation with one of my advisors, Sid Taro. He said, pick two Catholic countries, you know, for your research there, and thus Slovenia and Poland. And to kind of make it not just about Catholicism, I didn't want the argument to be so simplistic. And instead, I was really thinking about how the Catholic Church functions in very different ways in different states. And so other sociologists of religion have pointed out to these kind of things, but you know, I was trying to apply it to the IR norm literature to think about that quite carefully. And we do see really different trajectories. And so in Poland, the Catholic Church was actually a liberalizing force. It was on the side of democratic movements. It had a lot to say in the 90s about women's reproductive rights and also about LGBT rights, and they were opposed on both fronts. And so there was this really strong connection between the national identity and the religious one. And actually in the 90s, and that's dissipating now a little bit, but there was also, Poles themselves felt to be very Catholic, and they also felt that the Catholic Church has a lot of political authority. In Slovenia, that has, the church has a different history. They didn't have the same kind of on the side of the people role during communism. In fact, they're actually remembered to be a little, you know, collaborating in some cases, even during National Socialism, during the Second World War. And there was, it just didn't have this kind of memory in the national psyche the way it did in Poland, as being a stalwart defender of the Polish people against various occupations and defending the nation against various foreign impositions, at which they, the church, with, you know, with some political elites, and were able to translate that LGBT rights was also a foreign idea and imposition that we have to defend the nation from. That just wasn't as possible in Slovenia. We could say the same thing about Spain, for example, where the church lost a lot of credibility due to its ties with Franco, and didn't have the same kind of role coming out of democratization there. So the argument is basically that we have to think about how religion connects to nation to understand when it will be an effective force against LGBT rights, or when it might not be that much of a force against it. And so that was the point of that paper.
Yeah, it's really interesting from this point of view that, you know, even though they are in the same region, Slovenia and Poland, that because of their different trajectory of a regime change in the 1990s would affect allies to the LGBTQ movement this differently. So I think that these kind of differences in kind of global history are really, really relevant to how the LGBTQ movement would succeed or like would be in different kind of developments as well as in Hungary and Poland too. So now, most recently, your focus more shifted on this kind of like global conservative fight against the movement, right?
Yes.
Your most recent book is written with Christina Stock. So why did your focus shift onto this? Who undermines them, LGBTQ rights, and what are your main findings in this book?
Yeah, so I actually met Christina in 2013 and 14 when I was a postdoc at the UI. We were both postdocs there in Florence. And, you know, I was finishing the first book, which was about how LGBT people use transnational channels to diffuse rights. And Christina is an expert on the Russian Orthodox Church, a sociologist of religion. And we were talking, we met at a talk of Anna Jamal Buso, who is also presenting some work also thinking about the politicization of religion. And so we were talking, and it was becoming increasingly, what we were observing around us was that more what we call moral conservative actors, or actors who are also working to oppose LGBT rights and also women's reproductive rights and kind of affirm traditional gender roles, that those actors were increasingly also using transnational advocacy tools. And so in a way, it was, you know, a bit of a parallel that we saw there, that they were learning from the LGBT movement and from other progressive human rights movements that they should use these international venues, they should come together across borders. And that is something that for us was a little bit surprising, because a lot of them have a deeply nationalist ideology and deeply religious ideologies that might make it harder for, you know, nationalists to work together across borders with other nationalists, or for people with really entrenched religious views in one particular denomination to work together with other denominations, for example, in the way that we see these actors now doing. And so that was a bit of a puzzle. And the book does chart, you know, that there are these, there are international advocacy groups, so organizations that unite activists from around the world, from different world regions. They have meetings in different places, including one they had in Budapest, World Congress Families, for example. We see also that there's certain states that work kind of as norm entrepreneur states to support this movement, and we see certain IOs like the Catholic Church or the Orthodox Church that also give a lot of fodder to these movements. And so that creates a bit of a puzzle for some of our theories in international relations, because we might, you know, often we theorize that the progressive movements are working in the international space, and then they meet their resistance when they hit the domestic space where they're targeting a certain country, and then that country says no, and then they have to work to kind of convince that country that to adopt this norm. But it seems increasingly, especially in this era of kind of populist nationalism, where we see the circulation of all sorts of ideas and also waves of, politics that are pushed by right-wing conservatives that are being mimicked and copied in many different places, that of course that these channels are available to all sorts of movements. And that means that LGBT movements and women's movements also confront this resistance at different levels. So they're also meeting their opposition in international spaces. And the moral conservative movement, so this anti-LGBT movement, is also diffusing a lot of language, so we can see these concerns around quote-unquote protecting children from gay propaganda. Those kind of laws are popping up in multiple different places, including, again, the Florida example is a variant of that. Of course, Hungary introduced a law like that in 2021. The Russians have a law like that. Many states have laws like that. There's also all sorts of laws around religious liberty or, protecting children that crop up in many different states, or many anti-trans laws that look very similar across different world regions. And they're being organized by activists like this who are also diffusing certain ideas. And so we argue that we have to take that seriously, mm-hmm. both theoretically and empirically in the book, to understand how that shapes world politics. And we also have to think I think that has general implications for movements of all sorts, but for the LGBT movement, is also really interesting to see how the LGBT movement has responded to that, how it also speaks in a different language, in part given that they have to meet their opposition at so many different levels, not just in distinct domestic contexts, but really have to think on a global level too at how these challenges are coming their way at the UN or at the EU, etc.
Right. So we talked about Poland already, and yesterday in your talk at the Inequalities Workgroup, it was really interesting to me that you brought Poland as an example for a locally rooted messaging, which is a term that you introduced to describe a strategy that LGBTQ activists can use in order to accept their rights more in their own country, sort of. So, yeah, I wonder why this kind of foreign imposition is present everywhere, and that how did you find this method of locally rooting in activist culture, or was it first kind of something in the theory that you were talking about with your co-authors?
Well, first I noticed that happening in activism, which my co-authors noted as well. And the reason, yesterday I was presenting a paper on Zimbabwe, which was co-authored by my colleague Adam Harris at UCL, who works on African politics and has done a lot of work in Zimbabwe, which also put Zimbabwe on the radar for us. And then we had conversations with activists there that kind of inspired this this project, where we're testing how different activist messages are being used and which ones are most convincing to the general population. But the whole theoretical framework on rooting, or these rooting messages, came, and that's why I talked about Poland as well, they came from an earlier paper and earlier interactions with activists. And Poland is a case that I've thought about a lot over the years. And a paper that I wrote with Agnieszka Shitai, it was published in Social Movement Studies, where we looked at movement-counter-movement interaction and traced the Polish movement's frames for over 20 years. And we really argue that they shifted their framing considerably at different stages. And as the opposition intensified, especially in the mid-2000s, and we had this period of conflictualization where opposition movements started really targeting the LGBT movement and saying they were foreign imposition or foreign agents, that they were dismantling national values. And this really led to a shift there in the Polish movement, also starting to using more kind of a memory politics, really trying to root what we call rooting, root the movement by, uncovering indigenous expression around LGBT rights, by even incorporating sometimes religious themes into their activism, because calling March Love Thy Neighbor, as the motto, because they were also trying to appeal to a Catholic majority country, or using national symbols more than the global ones, which had been so central to their activism in years earlier, and in the broader, more abstract human rights frames, which had been really central. And so when Zimbabwean activists were talking to us about these dynamics, you know, of course, in a different way, in terms of what is rooted there is different than what is rooted in another country, obviously, but they were challenging, you know, similar kinds of activists, in Zimbabwe. Opponents say that LGBT rights are neocolonial imposition from the West. In Poland, opponents say that it's, you know, quote unquote, Ebola from Brussels, from article that my colleagues studied and wrote, the same kind of, you know, outside imposition is present in both cases. And so yeah, this rooting framing is something that activists are doing in many different places. And we, in the paper with Adam, we wanted to do a survey experiment where we'd use different kinds of rooting frames that activists use and test and see how, you know, what kind of responses the general population has to them. And so we did this experiment in May of last year, and it was really, this is still a working paper, it's not published, but it was really interesting how, so one, there's no negative backlash to negative to rooted messages at all, which that was really affirming and inspiring. And indeed, they do actually positively move people in different types of rooting messages, move responses around whether it's about rights or whether it's about accepting a neighbor or someone close to you in your circle. It makes sense why different ones move different people on different issues, you know, different outcomes. But those findings have been really inspiring. I mean, that's a study I'm was very happy to share for the first time actually here in Budapest, because Adam and I have been very excited about it, and we hope that that it will get published somewhere in the future. Yeah.
So upon this, what do you think are kind of the main differences in kind of challenges that Hungarian, Polish, and Central European activists face as opposed to or in comparison to Zimbabwean activists, for example?
Yeah, well, I mean, the main difference, and this would take me back to the international level, which we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, that while there are really resistant movements and resistant political elites in many of these countries that you mentioned, Poland and Hungary are still embedded in kind of an international framework, which is the European Union, that really establishes LGBT values or LGBT rights as part of European values. That's something that hasn't been established in every region in the same way, and that I still think that really, despite that it might also feed into this idea that LGBT people are foreign in certain countries, at the end of the day, it still provides a lot of, whether it's resources, like you mentioned actually before, in terms of supporting civil society in certain ways, or whether it's, just legitimacy that LGBT people who have certain benchmark of rights coming also from this level, or certain kind of examples and can engage with activists in other places due to free movement of people. These things really do matter, I think, in a way that you might have these governments really doubling down, and activists still have a huge struggle. They still have a lot of work, you know, brokering these contentious issues to a local audience, so they can't just cookie cutter take the examples of what worked in Germany and do it in Hungary. It does take much work in the same way as you would see in Zimbabwe, but there is a knowledge system, I guess, at the regional level that provides some conditions for norm diffusion that I think are still a little bit higher, despite the intense backlash that we still see in Central Eastern Europe. And that I think is a condition that is absent in Africa. That doesn't mean that you can't still have pan-regional activism in Africa as well. And I think activists are inspired and connected to other activists across borders, given that there are many similar threats. So we've seen this again in a recent wave of political homophobic, laws and rhetoric coming from multiple countries, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in other places that target LGBT people. And so there are similar, challenges to confront in many places. But I think that there is still less support. And then the other thing that I think really that we have to think about with Africa is that the anti-LGBT movement is really connected to transnational support in important ways. One, of course, the irony of calling LGBT rights neocolonial is that actually, you know, colonialism did deliver homophobia and anti-sodomy laws, especially British colonialism, to much of the continent and other parts of the world as well. But then also we have this moral conservative movement that we just talked about that is also targeting countries like this where they feel like they can still win. And so you see a lot of evangelical Americans and also Europeans, people coming from, you know, ideas coming from the global north that are also being exported, you know, anti-LGBT ideas and support for bills and policies being introduced there that make this a really complicated situation for activists working in Zimbabwe and other African states. And so that there are very, very important differences. Also the level, you know, the threshold level of support in society, if you compare, you know, Zimbabwe to, you know, countries that have homophobic challenges in Europe, it's still on quite different level. You know, I mean, even what we and the press, sometimes you see Poland being a very challenging case. It is a challenging case, but you know, the society there has moved tremendously on LGBT rights in recent years. We don't have that level of movement, that level of that, you know, that benchmark of support in society, which makes it, I think still quite a bit more possible to have further movement more quickly in some of these cases where there's a lot of challenging work to be done for activists in Zimbabwe.
Right. And so finally, some like bigger picture questions. Could you highlight some important milestones that you think that the LGBT activism gave to democratic participation? Because as you mentioned, this positive example of a rooted messaging, I think this is, for example, a kind of a tool that also maybe other social movements could implement.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's a hard one to answer, but I think also a really important question to think about, because the LGBT movement, I mean, I think if you look at the degree of attitudinal change and also change in legal frameworks of many different countries to become more inclusive to LGBT people despite intense backlash, it's really remarkable how much the world has changed on this issue. So I think this movement is one that all political scientists and sociologists should be studying very seriously to understand how was this possible. And I think there's, you know, I think the fact that LGBT activists have worked across borders, because many of them felt excluded from the nation everywhere, so they were able to build ties with each other where they felt like they had a lot in common with other lesbian, gay, trans people in different contexts that brought them together in a way. And they really innovatively also used international and transnational platforms for their work. Even before the EU had a social mandate, they were already, you know, visionarily targeting these institutions. And so I think that there's a lot to learn from in that. And I think also LGBT people cross-cut a lot of different other demographic groups if we think intersectionally about their rights and how, you know, how you have LGBT people across different class and racial divides. And these are also important ways in which, you know, this issue, once there was a threshold degree of visibility that people could express themselves slightly more easily in certain contexts, you all of a sudden see difficult conversations around sexuality and gender identity happening in very different echelons of society. I think also one thing, and this is a bit of a, you know, I guess more just a theory, but I think what's really interesting about LGBT people is a lot of us grow up in families that don't understand each other. And so there's a lot of brokerage happening even as a child in terms of having to explain, you know, and think about who you are. This can be very traumatizing. I'm not wanting to celebrate this, but there is a way of, you know, even loving people that don't understand you. And I think in a way that has also been for activists maybe a bit of a secret weapon, in that they've had to compromise and talk with people in ways that might lead to some kind of effective ways to push the dial on getting people to understand each other. And again, that's just a hunch or a theory of mine. I've been wanting to write something about that for years now, and I haven't really explored it yet because I'm not a philosopher, but I think there is something to that in the way that LGBT movement, once there was a degree of visibility around it, opened up the door for a lot of successes. I would like to qualify that when we talk about the successes, there's a lot of people and groups within the LGBT communities that have been left out. We see a lot of the rights affecting mainly upper middle class white gay men. We don't see the same access to rights and inclusion for many other groups under the LGBTI umbrella. Certainly when we see the attacks on trans people, also when we see, you know, how queer people of color are treated in many different societies that we consider as LGBT friendly. We also see issues of homonationalism, where when some gays and lesbians have rights in certain and become part of a nation, how their rights can also be exploited to limit the human rights of other groups. And this is something that we have to keep well aware of when we're talking about successes, also that there's a really, I think, long way to go in terms of making our societies more inclusive for queer people holistically. And LGBT activists are doing a lot of this great work still. So right. I'm hopeful, despite the intense resistance, that we can see more developments, but there is still a long way to go.
Great. Well, thank you for this conversation, Philip. It was really nice to have you here, as well as yesterday at our seminar. And I hope to see you soon in Budapest or elsewhere. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Esther.
I hope that you enjoyed listening to this conversation, and I will see you next time at the Review of Democracy.